I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Today we are going to talk about the election coming up in France. Last year we had Brexit, we had Trump. This year are we going to have Le Pen? That's the big question in everybody's mind. And I'd like you to talk to us about who the players are in this election. And do you think Le Pen has a real shot? So take it away.
Sure. Well, I do think that Le Pen does have a shot, indeed. However, the structure of the election, I think when we spoke about a year and a half ago after one of the terrorist attacks, I said we needed a divided right and a united left.
Right.
And it looked like we were going into this thing with a united right and a divided left, the opposite of a good environment in which she could win. However, that may change in the next, I think, what is it, 56 days or 55 days from now, before the first vote.
Let's just pause here just to remind our naive burger Americanus listeners. The French election has a double structure. There are two actual elections, two actual votes. So can you talk about the basic structure just as a little background?
Sure thing. The first round will take place on the last Sunday in April. And it's a, and also just, I think it's something that's very hard to fake too, the numbers, because the way it works in any election, you vote on only, you only have one choice, essentially. You get an envelope, you walk to a table, you have stacks of basically slips of paper representing each party, and if it's your legislative body, it might be for a list of candidates, right? Or in this case, you just have one individual in that party. You take as many of these as you want. You know, it's a secret ballot, right? And then you walk into a closet and you put only one of those into an envelope. You put the rest into the trash, seal the envelope, walk out, and you drop your envelope into a clear plastic box in front of many, many witnesses. And then at the end of the day, these physical ballots are counted. And really, in a very short time after, the national results are available. And right now, Marine Le Pen is, and has been for quite some time, the number one in the polls. She's in a very similar situation to what Trump was in the early months of the campaign, in the primary, where everyone was saying he's got a high floor and a low ceiling, right? Because she's basically been bouncing between 27 and 29, for months and months and months. And the question is, once she gets to the second round, can she win against whoever she's against? Now, will she be against the center-right candidate, the guy from the same party as former President Nicolas Sarkozy?
And they're called the Republicans.
Now they're called the Republicans. That, yeah, that's right. Now they're called Les Republicans. Yeah. Okay. My joke is if this rebranding doesn't work, the next is going to be Les Lacudniks. Yeah. Yeah, so that was for a long time the favorite to get into the second round. However, he's had a very bad month, which we'll get into in a little bit. Next is the dark horse centrist candidate who was totally unknown a year and a half ago, let's say. I mean, he had a government post, but he just wasn't a famous person at all. And then he's become kind of a celebrity character. Paris Match, the magazine. It's kind of like a highbrow People magazine did this enormous spread on him before he quit the government, and basically making the point that he's capable of winning, that he appeals to the center left and the center right, all these things which are still remain his strengths today. And in fact, at this point, he's the number one candidate in the current.
What's his name?
Macron, M-A-C-R-O-N, Emmanuel Macron. So.
And what's his party?
Well, it's his own party. It's just like he started it fresh, his own. I think the name escapes me at the moment, but it's only a legal structure that exists to make him president. And he didn't get the support of François Bayrou, who's the former centrist candidate of a number of elections. And that guy used to get, I think his worst was maybe like 8%, like the high single digits in the low teens is basically how he would do. And he's backed Macron, and then after him, the Socialist Party had a primary and very wisely rejected the current prime minister. the current president was the most unpopular president in the history of the Fifth Republic, and maybe in the history of any sovereign since Louis XVI. His approval ratings are, I think they've even been down in the high single digits, you know, but for a long time they're in the low teens. He announced that he would not be running late last year.
So that's Valls and...
Hollande is the current president, and Valls is the prime minister. And the prime minister is highly unpopular for a lot of reasons. He's a big Zionist. He's definitely has like an authoritarian streak. And he also passed a liberalizing in the French sense, so like a more free market-oriented laws related to work, you know, new labor laws that were highly unpopular with the left-wing base of the Socialist Party. And that was really the unraveling of their party. In fact, I was at a wedding, when was this? Probably late last spring, and I was there at a table with someone who was an elected official in the Communist Union, someone who was a local elected official for the Green Party, and one of their relatives who was like a middle-of-the-road, socially liberal, but wealthy doctor from a city. And the first two, I mean, it was the most damning thing that he could probably come up with was saying, he's like, did we elect, you know, this socialist president to practice the politics of the right or the politics of the left? And he's like, what the hell are they doing? You know? And that was around the time that his party had abandoned their coalition with the Socialist Party. In fact, almost, I think every other small minor party abandoned their grand left coalition over the last year and a half. and actually the woman from the city who was, you know, like socially liberal, upper middle class, was very excited about Macron. And that was the first time I'd heard anybody, really talk about him as like their choice of president, you know. And yeah, he's got this weird charisma that attracts a broad swath of people but we'll get into that later. But, and then I guess if we continue to move left, so we talked about the FN, we talked about Les Républicains, we talked about the Centrist Party, and now the Socialist Party, they have Benoît Hamon instead of Valls or Hollande. And this guy won the primary, and he's kind of untainted by the last few years, and that's what helps him. And he's actually received the backing of the Green Party, which is, you know, it's not big, but it's meaningful. You know, they had, I think they're polling only so far around 3 or 4% this year. They historically have done better, though. And then we have a guy from the front of the left, right, the Front de Gauche, and he has since enveloped the Communist Party of France. And these guys are kind of neck and neck, right around, you know, 13-14%, him and the socialist. And this is a really much more of a political celebrity than an actual, you know, governing politician, right? He's, you know, famous for always being invited on television, and he is very, very passionate anti-racist and passionate anti-Front National character named Jean-Luc Mélenchon. And he's the only, I mean, really the only charismatic person on the left at any level of politics for quite some time. I mean, to the point where he actually retired from politics for a couple years. And when he retired, he said, if you want me to run for president, I'll come back. and then he did. And then when he did so, he did in a very insulting way to a lot of the structures on the left, including the Communist Party. And then they just kind of fell in line behind him because he's, you know, the only game in town, essentially.
Is he sound on the economic issues that animate the left, or is he just a leftist social signaler, anti-racist type?
So he's got both. That's what sets him apart from all the other famous politicians, is that he's both anti-capitalist and anti-racist. And now I'm not sure, I did an analysis of how many actual French voters are anti-racist above all, and I think that it's only about 8% of the voters, which is actually below the non-white population percentage for France. So I think that a lot of his support comes from traditional left-wing union voters, you know, CGT, communist union voters, which is actually a base that's breaking apart for the left, and many of them are increasingly defecting to the Front National in the recent elections.
That's why I was asking. I was wondering if he actually has anything positive to give to these union voters,
yeah.
Or if he's just, you know, talking about basically left-wing identity politics, and essentially globalization plus left-wing identity politics is sort of what the Democratic Party has turned into,
yeah,
in the United States.
And that's what the centrist Macron is offering. You know, here's the thing. I know that a lot of people are getting afraid of him in the press. He's had, you know, three very strong weeks, and he polls very high in the second round, as would Fillon as well. But he's playing this game where he doesn't define himself very well. He's very new to having this kind of spotlight on him. He didn't grow up with it the way that Marine Le Pen did, certainly. But even compared to the others he's against, I mean, you know, François Fillon is a former prime minister. He's been in the public eye for a very, very long time. So he's used to this sort of thing. Mélenchon, same thing. But Macron is, and he's not even, I think he's in his late 30s. I can't remember exactly the age. But just a very inexperienced guy. And I remember a phrase that was used by a Texas politician about centrist politics. He said that the only thing that you find in the middle of the road are yellow lines and dead armadillos. And I think that Macron is going to be finding it harder and harder in the next month and a half to please everybody in the way he's been doing. And he's already starting to do that. He said something recently about how the colonization project was a crime against humanity, right? And then when he tries to make peace with, say, some of the older crowd of voters who were against the gay marriage legislation, he says that, you know, they were handled with disrespect, something like this. So I think that, you know, he managed in one interview to piss off, you know, the left and the right at the same time. And I think that it's easier to piss each one side and the other off by saying kind words than it is to please everybody. And I think that'll be increasing the case. And also it's evidence that he is, you know, as a capitalizing technocrat and an internationalist, and also that he's going to come out and say that colonization was a crime against humanity and a number of other, you know, leftist platitudes, that he really is a creature of the modern globalist left that you just described.
Right.
Yeah.
So we've got the pawns and bishops and other figures set up on the board. So what do you think Le Pen's chances are in the first round and the second round? And what are some of the factors you think might shake this election up over the next few weeks? I know there's some things rumbling away in the background that could change the game entirely. So talk about Macron, talk about Fillon, and the scandals that have been emerging recently.
Well, for Macron, his scandals have not really broken yet in a big way. There's one scandal that I think would be useful to exploit in the second round, and I've actually been in contact with folks who are trying to get this material and to use it in a politically effective way. That is that, so he's married to a woman who's, you know, about two decades older than him, who was once his high school teacher. Very interesting thing. And now to become president of France, he has to seduce millions and millions of older ladies like this.
Cat lady.
Yeah. And he has the charm to do it, but it turns out that there is that he's a swinger, essentially. That he has a, you know, sometimes you see things where, like, everybody knows a secret. Like, everybody knew Jimmy Savile was a pedophile, or everybody knew this or that about some public figure. Everyone knew JFK was sleeping around, right? But it's only that closed circle of people. About a year ago, in a, you know, when this Paris Match article came out, and there's a roundtable discussion on television about him, and one of the journalists made a joke that he's very liberal, meaning, you know, capitalist, in his economic approach, and he said, as he is in his morals, which would mean like a sexual libertine. And then everybody around the table is laughing and cracking up. A couple people made another, like, quick little punchy comments. But then, like,
Everybody knows.
Yeah, and then, right? Suddenly, the lid falls on it, and it's like, okay, no more jokes about this. We're not going to talk about what we mean. And nothing's been said since. And more recently, Closer, which is like a celebrity tabloid magazine of the kind of, say, not even like National Enquirer. National Enquirer has like other stuff about news and public figures. Like, this is like a pure celebrity tabloid, essentially. And they had a video of him walking hand in hand with a forest with a man who is the head of a state-owned broadcasting body, and who's also famously out of the closet. And so they were going to run this, and then the rumor is that Nicolas Sarkozy intervened. Nicolas Sarkozy, who's not a supporter officially of Macron, intervened to prevent this from being published. Now, the timing of this, I believe, was after Sarkozy lost the primary for the right-wing party. And so it was his former prime minister and subsequent rival who won the vote. But he prevented this guy who was his opponent, from having this thing that might hurt him come out. So anyway, that might come out. I think that the bigger scandal would be, because frankly, in general in France, sexual scandals are not as big of a deal. And two, for a guy who's he sits in a part of the political terrain where this doesn't matter. His base doesn't care about this kind of stuff. And I think that what would really hurt him is something akin to the Mitt Romney comments that really hurt him when he was running for president. About 47% of the country doesn't pay federal taxes, therefore, basically they're losers who want to spend other people's money. And there is, set base of opposition from the beginning. That kind of comment would rub French people even worse than it did in America. Like, that would really bother a lot of people in a bigger way. And it would cut into his base of, say, moderate socialist party voters. Now, there is a scandal that is clearly there's something there, and we don't have, a smoking gun yet. But he worked for the Rothschild Bank for about a year and a half, and he made almost $3 million there. It's kind of like, and it's like one of those deals that Rahm Emanuel had, where when he quit the Congress, he went to work in an investment bank in New York, and he made a fortune in a very, very short amount of time, right? This guy made almost $3 million in under 2 years.
Right. I think they're actually paying him for future services.
Correct.
That's probably what's going on here.
Exactly.
I'm sure Rahm Emanuel was being paid for future services as well.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure he didn't spend a single moment on a spreadsheet looking at prices and net present values or anything.
Wasn't sweating with a green eye shade on.
Right, definitely not.
And Schwitzing.
Is Schwitzing. And we know with Emmanuel Macron that for over 8 years he made $4.9 million. This is all public record stuff. Now, in his most recent financial disclosure, which was required to be a government minister, he had a net wealth of $63,000.
Okay, there's a problem there. Yeah.
Big problem.
Unless his wife spends a lot of money or he has a drug habit or something like that.
Right.
I don't, can you spend, even if you have the worst coke habit in the world, can you run through that amount of money in that amount of time?
Hard to imagine.
It doesn't seem likely.
I think Michael Jackson would have a hard time even spending money that fast, maybe. But right. No, I mean, and it's not a thing where he has a, he paid $4.9 million for a $5.3 million house, and he's got a mortgage left over. It's just that, he has, when you look at his balance sheet, it's very small stuff. So there's something going, so that means that his money is somewhere that is unaccounted for. You can't, if you're a French citizen, you can't put your money in Monaco. It is harder to put it in Switzerland now than it was before, but it's going to be somewhere, and it's going to be in one of these, you know, British Virgin Islands is popular lately with the French. It's going to be in one of these, tax evasion centers, you know.
I just love it. All these liberals with numbered foreign bank accounts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's going to be his case. And so as soon as we...
It's the Clinton Club, basically. He's a Clinton Club person.
Precise.
He's a center-left, hyper-signally person who's obviously incredibly greedy and corrupt and also debauched.
Yeah.
Great. I mean, what could possibly go wrong running a candidate like that, right? What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. And so far, nothing's gone wrong. I mean, he's been going nowhere but up in the polls. And he's just like he's exactly what the voters thought they were going to get in Hollande. You know, because before with Sarkozy, they called him the bling bling president, you know. And in fact, when Sarkozy was busy, you know, allegedly doing coke and banging models, Fillon was the guy, the current center-right candidate, was the guy as prime minister who was actually working away, creating legislation, building coalitions, working on policy, right? He was the workhorse. And, you know, part of the vote for Hollande, who was, you know, probably the least presidential looking of any French president, you know, he doesn't have that, I guess, you know, other than Sarkozy, was that...
He doesn't have a chin. I mean,
yeah. Well, they thought, like, okay, let's get a guy who's got no drama, you know? And
no charisma.
Yeah, exactly. They were willing to trade that off, right? But then what happened, you know, like, what was it, 6 months after he was elected, he gets divorced from his wife, who he was campaigning side by side with. He gets, his mistress tries to kill herself, and he's filmed by a tabloid journalist, paparazzi, walking around in public outside of his new mistress's apartment with a motorcycle helmet on, with the visor flipped up. Before he gets on his motorcycle and visor down and speeds away back to the Elysee Palace. Which is like, I mean, a head of state is wandering around his city doing this, you know? So, you know, they thought they were getting a guy who was no charisma, no drama, just go to work for us and don't make waves, you know? And instead they got a guy who was, you know, who secretly wished he was a bling bling like Sarkozy, you know. And as soon as he got into the big seat of power, he took advantage of it in that way and didn't address the fundamental problems that face France, you know, in the post economic crisis era, you know, and the fact that unemployment is more persistent in France than it is in any neighboring country, you know, and what's he busy thinking about? He's busy thinking about, you know, his coterie of women, you know.
And also sneaking out without apparently his bodyguards. That's incredibly reckless behavior.
Incredibly reckless.
And it doesn't just endanger him, it endangers the whole republic.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, and never have, you know, civil liberties been as limited as they are now. It's really, it used to be that just the, you know, the FN or others would have to worry about whether or not they get permits for going out in public. But now it's, you know, anyone who wants to have a pro-Israel rally has a pro-Israel rally without a problem. Anyone who wants to have a pro-Palestinian rally simply can't have one. Any rallies that are critical of French foreign policy towards Libya and so on, you know, these are just, you know, increasingly stopped. If they treated unemployment with the intensity that they treat Dieudonné, the country would probably be in a lot better shape.
Well, they've got their priorities straight, then.
Exactly,
right?
Yes. The avant-garde, actually, Valls, the prime minister, called the Jewish community the avant-garde of the republic. And so
indeed they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's following their preferences.
Yeah.
Globalization and cultural Marxism, basically. Those are the preferences of the Jewish community.
I really think that I imagine the worst part of his week, maybe even every other day, is when he has to get on the phone with the head of the French version of the ADL, and the guy starts saying, "What the hell are you gonna do about this Dieudonné?"
Yeah.
And he's got to say, well, you know, we've been sending bodyguards to count the number of people in his shows when he's abroad, and we're trying to figure out how much money he's making there, and we took all this money from his house. And then, like, next week, same thing. What the hell is happening with this guy? Why is he still walking the street? And we know that this is the kind of relationship that people in power have to the people who are supposedly in power, the face of our government, right? They actually have these kinds of conversation. They have this kind of relationship with the leadership of the organized Jewish community.
Right. And with Valls, I mean, not only does he have to deal with that on the phone, he's got to deal with that in bed every morning. The first thing he hears when he opens his eyes is his wife. What are you doing about Dudenay,
basically? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, in fact, there was a former minister of the Mitterrand government, which was the first socialist government of the Fifth Republic, who referenced that once in public. It was great, because he's like 90 years old, and I think at that point you kind of don't care anymore about what people think. And so he said exactly that on television. And I think he got a lot of respectful nods from a lot of French people, and then a lot of finger wagging from the media elite in Paris.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's segue to Fillon. What's going on with him?
So I'll start from the, you know, a little bit of background on him and what makes him different from the other leadership of the center right. And I don't want to sound like we're getting into Alex Jones kind of territory here when I talk about this, because I think in the United States, Masonry, maybe when Truman was president or before that, had some kind of power as a network, right? And now when people talk about it, it's kind of like, all right, I'm listening to a kook, right? But in France, it really remains an important network of power. And it's split, unlike in the United States, into several different groups. And the Grand Orient is backing the Front de Gauche, the leader of the Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the anti-racist, is very popular with them, and he's a very public proponent of them, and vice versa. They have a very warm, cozy relationship. That's the kind of masonry that now accepts women, and for over a century has accepted atheists, and has always been a very anti-clerical, and they got into... Yeah, there were scandals of the past where they were involved in literally sending out their lodge members to spy on military officers to see what the military officers did on Sunday morning. And it's called l'affaire des fiches, like the scandal of index cards, because they created this huge index, this reference of which military officers were Catholic, and to what extent they were Catholic, as part of their efforts to prevent, anti-Dreyfusard stuff, to prevent a Boulanger kind of general taking over, to prevent any kind of reaction. Right? Now, the traditionalist Masons are in a number of different groups, and they actually, the main one is the Grand Lodge Nationale de France, and that became the network within it which a lot of French-African corruption occurred. They had a big campaign to get French-speaking African heads of state involved, and it really came to fruition a little bit in the Chirac years and really finished in the Sarkozy years, where, all that famous corruption of, the aid that comes into Africa ends up in, bank accounts in France or buying bags at Louis Vuitton and on the Champs-Élysées, right? And being spent in these fantastic hotels of Paris. And a scandal came out when Sarkozy was running for re-election, when the Grand Master of that obedience, as they call it, that version of the GLNF, he wrote a letter to him saying, that you have 50,000 soldiers behind you, ready to support you all the way back to the Élysée Palace and so on and so forth, right? And this guy had been the leader of this group for, almost 20 years. Now, when there was a division that occurred after that, and the new group that separated out, they chose as their leader Alain Juppé. Alain Juppé is the number two guy who ran and lost in the primary against Fillon, actually. So in the primary that was, you know, recently held for the Republicans to decide what who their candidate would be, you had Sarkozy, who was this GLNF. And in the GLNF, there are tons of scandals that come out, especially in the southeast of France, which is kind of like a mafia culture area, related to these lodges, related to networks of guys, of business leaders and politicians who meet on a bi-monthly basis in these lodges and who figure out how to profit off the public's back, right? So you had Sarkozy, who had this cozy relationship with the GLNF. You had Alain Juppé, the mayor of Bordeaux in the southwest, who was leading this breakaway group. And then you had Fillon, who is like all by himself as a Catholic with roots in the Vendée region, which is the counter-revolutionary region of France. The only one who really stuck his neck out against gay marriage, which was hugely popular with their base, but not very popular with their political leadership. And for some reason also, he, despite being prime minister for and well-respected as prime minister, he had lost back in 2012 the race to be the head of the party. Instead, Sarkozy handed over the reins from himself to a guy named Jean-François Copé, which sounds very French. It's actually Jean-François Copovici. He's a Romanian Jew, in fact, and from the same criminal networks, alleged criminal networks as Sarkozy. Right?
So Sarkozy is also part Jewish. Is he part, yes, Romanian Jew, or is he Hungarian Jew?
Hungarian, yeah.
Okay.
And he and Copé are in tight. And in fact, now the current president of the party is Christian Jacob. So also
with a name, an odd name, Christian for a Jew, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It'll maybe trick some of the goy, but not so many. Yeah. And so now the rumor had been in the past that Fillon would have accepted alliances with the Front National. I'm sorry if I'm really backtracking so much to give the history of this, but I mean almost. Yeah, as with the center-right in Germany, you know, at one point, Merkel said, you know, the reason we exist is to stop the nationalist right, which I think must have left a lot of their voters scratching their heads, thinking that it was actually about, you know, social conservatism and free markets. You know, everything that, you know, that you can explain the moves that the elite have made in Sarkozy's party, only through, understanding their priority as being stopping the FN and nothing else. Because they had I think it was the regional elections, or either the regional or the departmental elections. It's one of these levels between municipal and national. The center-right party under Sarkozy went from controlling every one of these regions but two, as I recall, to only controlling two or three themselves. And had they made an alliance with the FN, you know, we talked about this two-round voting, had they made an alliance for the second round, they would have maintained control in almost all of these areas. They turned down power, and in fact, they basically told their voters, we will not exercise power in your name after you voted for us, because it's more important to us not to make alliances with the Front National. And if you look at the rank and file of the center-right party, this is the popular position to take. The popular position is to say, we will back the, we will combine with the FN in second rounds after we lose. And that's always been the fear. And I think that's to this day, it's a concern of a lot of these people, because Fillon is not one of them. He's 100% French. He's not a Mason. He's a practicing Catholic. You know, as opposed to all these other guys who are mixed, you know, Jewish, non-French origin, involved in, white collar crime, et cetera, and in these, you know, networks of people. So the primaries that were held, the three main candidates were Sarkozy, Juppé, the mayor of Bordeaux, and Fillon. Sarkozy was, you know, basically a no-show. Fillon had about one-third of support, and I'm sorry, Fillon had two-thirds of support, and Juppé, the Bordeaux mayor, the head of this Masonic, you know, the Grand Master, right, this breakaway Masonic group, he had one-third of the votes. Now, this scandal is, there's a scandal that's almost brought down Fillon's candidacy in the last month, and that is that his wife had been on his payroll for the last 15 years. And over these 15 years, that money added up to $680,000. And Fillon has been an elected official for, I think, about 34, 36 years. He's actually never been convicted of a crime. He's never been indicted on a crime. And has never had a scandal to speak of. And this but ever since this scandal broke, his numbers dropped from him being the number two candidate at about 25% to being, you know, I think the lowest I saw him was at 17 or 18%, and to the benefit of Macron, the centrist. So over the weekend, all of these other people within the party started turning on him. So a guy who was once Chirac's prime minister said that Fillon was off the rails, that he's radicalizing the party, and that he's, you know, launched on a personal adventure. That, and he even said that he will certainly not vote for Fillon. Right? Xavier Bertrand, Christian Strozzi, and Valérie Pécresse, who are leaders around the country, very senior members of the party, they called on Fillon to step down so that they could restore unity, so that they can defeat the FN. Right? And they included that every time. We need to have unity in order to defeat the FN. Who else? And then Fillon had a big rally on Sunday, and it was put together by one of the groups that was against gay marriage. And it was held at the Trocadero, which is in view of the Eiffel Tower. And according to the organizers, they had 200,000 people there. According to the police, it was 50. It's usually somewhere in between the, you know, the organizer numbers and the police numbers. If you find the number in between, that's usually the truth. So, I mean, tons of people there. So it was a great show of force. But when you look at the stage, I could only see one notable from his party. It was the former immigration minister under Sarkozy. That was the only person I saw. Jean-François Copé, this Jewish Romanian who was the head of the party after Sarkozy handed it over to him. He skipped the rally, even though he's a mayor in a neighboring wealthy suburb of Paris. And his excuse was, like, he didn't understand the purpose of the rally. You know, it's like, oh, this is such a bullshit excuse, you know. And that he was looking forward to, and he was part of the group that had called Fillon to a meeting of the central leadership of the party last night from this recording, so Monday night, March 6th, to clarify things. Essentially, they were trying to get him to quit. They're trying to put pressure on him in order to quit. Now, the irony of all this is that all these people were trying to get him off the ticket, were trying to replace him with Alain Juppé, the mayor of Bordeaux and this grandmaster. And now Fillon is accused of overpaying his wife $680,000. Juppé has actually been found guilty of the exact same crime at a much higher scale. And he actually had a number of other white-collar crimes that he's been actually found guilty of. And when he left the government, when he lost his parliamentary immunity, he immediately left the country for Canada and became a professor there. And all of his criminal proceedings took place while he was outside of the country. And he didn't return back until these criminal proceedings had been concluded. So, I mean, essentially he was in, you know, running from the law right. When he was doing this. And so they want to replace Fillon for being too corrupt and too scandal-ridden with a guy like this, who also was not the popular choice of the base of their party.
All right, well, this is very interesting, and what I'm seeing here as a possibility and maybe what the party leaders are seeing as a possibility is that Fillon is not one of them, he's not one of their inner circle,
yeah.
and that he might be actually more interested in representing the voters in the party, including striking deals with the Front National, than he is with basically pushing the Jewish globalist Masonic anti-nationalist agenda, which is the number one action item for the rest of the party leadership. Is that right?
So that was exactly my suspicion. And then today I see an interview with a former prime minister, Hafahan, and the things he said, his highlights were that we have to run an open, tolerant campaign and we must never make a deal with the FN. Now, this is so far from the focus of the meeting, which is, did Fillon commit crimes that make him ineligible to be president from a moral and ethical standpoint? And then practically, can he still win and do we have a better option? And he's focusing on this, open, tolerant campaign and never, ever make a deal with the FN. He must always remember to never make a deal. Now, Fillon is constantly saying in public as well, right before his meeting, he came out, he said, my number one target is the FN, and she's the one to beat, I mean, the guy's been a politician, though, for 36 years. So I think that at some point, even if maybe he's never stolen money from the people, I think at some point he learned how to lie. And so otherwise he wouldn't have survived this long. And so I would... just as skeptical as these guys in the head of their party, I think that he's not necessarily telling the truth when he says these things, and that he may very well cut a deal with the FN in the second round. And here's the way that such a deal might look, right? It may even be just by omission. He might say, I'm not going to tell people to support Macron or Le Pen, as opposed to years past when it's we must make a Republican front and all unite to beat it, right? So what will happen is if Marine Le Pen is president, she only has 3 members of parliament from her party. So the chances, she can't have her own prime minister, and France has a weak presidential system. So that means she can call referenda, which we've talked about in previous podcasts, where she puts it to the people to decide on if they agree with her or not on major questions, like an immigration moratorium, like membership in the EU, nature of the relationship with the EU, should they use the euro or the franc, these kinds of questions, right? Hopefully more of the first kind relating to immigration and so on. Now, she'll have control over foreign relations and, matters of state, but when it comes to domestic governance, when she's not in the same party as the prime minister, as the parliamentary majority, then that power rests more with the prime minister. So it's a weak presidential system as opposed to a strong presidential system like in the United States. Now, Fillon is a member of parliament. It's currently the socialists who are the majority. But if that were to change, which it certainly will after the next legislative elections, because the socialists are incredibly unpopular right now, he could create a coalition government in which he has a frenemy kind of relationship with Le Pen and would be her prime minister. And it's been made abundantly clear by all of the other leadership in the party that if this guy wants to have any kind of career after he loses the race for president, that is his only option. They will run him out of the party. They will not, they will not let him run the party, as they denied him in the past, and they'll not let him have a leadership position in the parliament. So I think that, after 36 years, he's got a sense of survival instinct, and also probably has a sense of purpose, and that could be, so you hear it here first on Countercurrents, that could be the deal that no one is talking about now, that no one believes is possible. We may wake up a week after the legislative elections that will occur a little while after the presidential election, and see Fillon once again as prime minister, and having a working relation, a modus vivendi, right? Like a working relationship where they agree on some things between him and Le Pen.
That would be great. That would be really interesting if it actually happens. And do you think that there's any discussion going on between Le Pen and Fillon right now? Or is there any wink, wink, nudge, nudge going on in the press or in the public that might telegraph these sorts of things down the line?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, and it would not be taking place between major elements of the party. I would guess that if there was a, like, if I wanted to create a back channel between the FN and Fillon, what I would do is I would go through these conservative Catholic networks that are behind the anti-gay marriage stuff. Because you have some people who are big FN donors and supporters, who are prominent citizens, but who are not elected officials in the FN. And then you also have other people who are not involved in the center-right party, but who are supporters of it, donors of it, who are, you know, wealthy leaders within this anti-gay marriage movement, who would be the ones who were standing on the stage with Fillon when he went to Trocadero and spoke to their group. Who would be the ones who would be inviting him to speak to socially conservative voters when he passes through, you know, Versailles or wherever. So that would be the back channel that I would create if I was in that situation. I wouldn't go through, Bruno Le Maire or one of these more nationalist-leaning UMP or, you know, Republican people, because I wouldn't trust them. Frankly, I wouldn't trust them. I mean, I think that there are too many careerists and there's too much backstabbing. And there is the feeling that, you know, like the Arabs say, a falling camel attracts many knives. And that's what we're seeing with Fillon here.
That's really interesting. So what do Le Pen's prospects look like in the first round in terms of percentage of the vote? Who do you think is going to be the lead candidate in the first round?
Yeah.
And what kinds of things could change the game? What kinds of events could change the game between now and the first round, between the first round and the second round?
Right. So Le Pen is, I think, everyone's favorite to be the top vote-getter in the first round. Now the question is, what is her ceiling? And so there was a recent poll that was just published, I'll just pull it up, in which 33% of French say that they are okay with the ideas of the Front National. So, okay, well, our question then is that our ceiling that we're dealing with here? But then, you know, we also have this unnamed source of someone who's close to François Hollande, the president, saying that he thinks in a private conversation, yeah, that's being reported in the press, that he thinks that she's going to get 10 points higher than what everyone thinks she's getting, which means that she's going to get, you know, 38 or 39% in the first round. Not including, you know, that's just the first round, you know, when we have five major candidates running. Yeah, and he also says that he thinks that it's going to be difficult for everybody to unite in the second round against her. This is what he's saying in private conversations. So, so is it, so I don't know. I don't know the answer, honestly. I'm still myself, very concerned about the second round. You know, I think it's within reach, but how close, you know, and it's going to be close, I'm afraid. But is it possible? I think it is possible. There are numbers on the second round, but the problem is there's this, the Wilder effect, right, where people are afraid to say that they're for Marine Le Pen when some stranger calls them on the phone and asks who they're going to vote for. And I think some of these numbers just have to be total bullshit, you know. So if Fillon loses, 46% of his voters are going to go to Macron and 33% to Le Pen, and 21% say that they're not going to vote at all. You know, and I just don't believe those numbers. I just think it's historically, there are voters who will either go in and turn in their envelope blank as a kind of protest, or who will simply stay home in the second round. But this is utter nonsense. There's a smaller candidate, named Nicolas Dupont-Aignan, who's, whose party is the sovereignist party, right? It's like a sovereignist, conservative, Catholic, pro-free markets, right-wing party, right? And he gets about, I don't know, I think it's like 5% of the vote or maybe a little bit less than that. And he's kind of a perennial candidate. And in fact, he's kind of the standard bearer. He doesn't say he's a royalist, but he's kind of the standard bearer of the royalist vote, essentially. And according to polls, 41% of his supporters are going to vote for Macron in the second round, and 18% will stay home. And it's just like, I mean, these people are anti-EU, and they're socially conservative. Why are they going to vote for a guy who is a socialist party minister who's like a pro-EU technocrat?
Right.
And it just, and who's pro-gay marriage when they're anti-gay marriage? You know, it just doesn't, and they really, unlike the majority of France, this is like an issue that they care deeply about, you know. I mean, it's just like, I think they're obviously lying. Now, if we were to take them though, at face value, and we're gonna look at second round votes, and we add up all of the people who are confirmed for Fillon in the second round, or confirmed for Macron in the second round. In both of these scenarios, if we take their opinions at face value, Marine Le Pen loses. However, Fillon only has 42% of confirmed votes, and Macron only has 50% of confirmed votes. So then the question becomes, how many people are actually going to break for Marine Le Pen of these supposed non-voters? And how many people are actually lying completely and saying they're going to support Macron or Fillon and are actually going to support her? So when we look at the numbers that way, it suddenly looks in reach. And I think the even better news beyond that is when we talk about the floor of these politicians. When people are asked, after they give their preference, who do you want to vote for? And then they say, are you sure of your choice? For Le Pen, it's 83%. For Fillon, it's 75%. And then for Macron and for the socialists, it's only 58%. So that is very, very shaky ground for them to be standing on. And so I feel as if it's in reach. It's going to be hard. I think it'll be close in the end. But it is within reach. And it will be the same thing that we saw before where, I mean, there's always a wilder effect with the Front National. And it's about, I mean, it's up to 5 or even 7% I've seen.
Interesting. So what can identitarians do between now and then? What can any of us do to mean Marine Le Pen into the presidency of France? And what are the sort of things, the sort of scandals, the sort of pranks, the sort of contingencies, historical contingencies that might happen between the first and second rounds that might put her in power? I mean, if there's another crazed kebab massacre in Paris, that could do
right.
it. What kinds of stuff could happen that could change this game?
So first I'll say that I'm actually, you know, very involved in this process of trying to find, basically creating a Dirty Tricks media campaign, and that's unrelated to the Front National. I'll say that, you know, there are some things that in France, political actors, activists, so on, are very good at compared to the United States. For example, going out in the street and having demonstrations, taking over a building, taking over the railway station, right, to protest Islamization after the knife attack that occurred on the train. You know, these kinds of things that they're very good at. Where Americans are much better is at dirty tricks. I remember I was having a conversation once with the head of the Front National for a mid-sized city where they're very prominent. And I was talking about things that I had been doing with American activists since I came to America. And I talked about how we were, we'd spray painted up around a black neighborhood, unemployment rate for young black men, 25%, unemployment rate for illegal alien Mexicans, 0%. Or just illegal Mexicans, 0%. And the guy looked at me like I was totally insane. And he was like, "What? What in the hell are you doing? Why are you doing this? Doesn't make any sense." They don't, And this was the head of the political wing, right? Of the group that was actually trying to win votes, right? They weren't, not the governing side, right? His focus was always on the next election and how to get more votes, you know? And so, yeah, thinking strategically in this way of dividing the other side or thinking about, is dirty tricks the right word for this, Greg?
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, thinking in this way is just not their strength. And so, and also which is kind of surprising when you think about all of the, you know, the government ministers in the history of the Fifth Republic who committed suicide, all of these, you know, dirty dealings that people have, that this kind of stuff, you know, this, it never occurs to them. And so, what I'm involved with doing is, looking at where we need to decrease turnout. Essentially, how do we black pill a lot of the older voters that the Front National is weak with? How do we black pill a lot of these kind of centrist cucks? How do we wake up people who are in very rural areas who think that the problems of mass immigration are Paris problems and not their, you know, not a problem for Brittany, not a problem for, you know, we're at Bordeaux, for example, that this is not something, you know, if they're far from the borders, if they have low unemployment rates, then these are areas where the FN is weak, where there's lots of diversity or they're close to a border and they have high unemployment. That's where the FN is strong. And so we have to either make some of these, you know, nationalist, blue-collar voters pull the lever for the first time for the FN, or convince them to stay home. And so, you know, those are the two things that I can – let's see. I guess I'm just going through the list of the special projects we have here. So some of them are going to be, you know, pushing news stories on Facebook to them on a, in a very targeted way. It'll be, push polls, robocalls, you know, these are the kind of cheap tactics that we'll be doing, and basically guiding the chaos in the, that is happening now, it's inevitable to happen again, in ways that are beneficial and that will be covered in the media. You know, I didn't even mention the violence that's been happening in the streets. You know, there was about a two and a half week period of violent riots when a young African man named Theo supposedly had a baton put in his anus by the police. And, you know, I think that, you know, people in the New York metropolitan area probably remember Amadou Diallo, right, where he was taken into a bathroom by a cop and the guy took a plunger and stuck it up his ass, you know, and the cop was eventually charged with assault for this and removed from the police force. And that, you know, when I'm remembering that story, this was my first thought. And in fact, it's not that at all. The guy was arrested. In fact, his arrest was filmed. And he was wearing jeans. And yet he was lying in a hospital bed for over a week from the injuries that he sustained from this involuntary sodomization by the hands of a police officer. And in fact, President Hollande went to visit him and shake his hand in his hospital room at the same time that riots were going on. And of course, you know, this only inflames the situation further. Now, over the last year, there's been an incredible amount of violence in the streets, especially in the city of Nantes and Rennes and in Paris itself and its surrounding areas, of course. And this is a lot of Antifa and far-left violence, starting with the reforms around labor laws. And most recently, when the FN went to Nantes, which is in the west of France, kind of the northwest, not quite in Brittany, but towards Brittany, they basically created mass violence in the streets to try and prevent routes to access the stadium where the meeting took place. And in fact, they had so many volunteers and such good intel that they even dropped flaming tires on a highway. And this is on film. And they blocked a highway with flaming tires. And then they had about 20 or 30 guys run out from the woods onto the highway with, paint bombs and baseball bats and other things, and attacked the buses that contained Front National volunteers who were just coming to watch the, or just supporters who were coming to, into the city to watch the event. The level of organization, the level of tactical preparedness, that these guys have and the level of intel is really mind-blowing. I think they're operating on a whole nother level from the Antifa and the far left in the United States. And this, I hope, has a depressing effect, if not a red-pilling effect, on the older baby boomer generation. It's hard to say. It's hard to say. It's too early to tell. But this kind of violence, and obviously, and this kind of violence is not as red-pilling as migrant violence. If there was migrant violence in these cities, I think that it would be much more red-pilling for them. But that's just an area with very few of them. These are the things on the ground. There will be more attacks. I think that whether it's of the nature of an ISIS-inspired attack, whether it's simply, a chimp out of people in the jungle in Calais or wherever else. People in that area are already red-pilled. Like, they're going to be FN to the core in that area. Or if it's going to be this kind of left-wing fights, this kind of thing is going to happen more and more until the election occurs. It will increase in intensity. And we have to make sure that it is guided in a way that is best politically for the Front National. And so, yeah, that's the way forward. It's funny too, because there's this great, I guess people are calling it the Trump effect in France, but, supposedly Marine Le Pen has similar problems with these fake employees. Now, the thing is, she has a platform to speak at the European Union, but it's not a platform to govern. So she'll pay people, as she has a right to do, as employees there, but what they do as employees of a member of European Parliament is not going to be the same, because it would be a waste of time, as somebody from a mainstream center-left, center-right, globalist, pro-EU kind of party. And so whenever the FN goes on television, they don't want to talk about, the interviewer only wants to talk about, well, doesn't Marine Le Pen also have this problem with fake employees? Or aren't you going soft on Fillon because you're afraid a bigger scandal will break with Le Pen? The thing is, with Fillon's voters, it hurts him. He lost, 7 or 8% of his support because of this problem. Marine Le Pen's base are anti-establishment. And so when they hear this, they think, good, screw them. Take their money. Great. They don't show them, they don't care. They don't care that she's doing this. And in fact, they like it. And then when they see the media talking about this, which is, essentially going to be a matter of a few $100,000 and not the invasion of the country and the replacement of its people, that makes them angrier at the media. And it makes them more, defiant against the opinions that they're told they're supposed to have. And so the dynamic in place is one that is, that can only improve the situation for Marine Le Pen. But it's still anybody's game right now. So, another thing that could change is that if the left wing two candidates on the left, if they were to decide to unite today, and if it was a perfect marriage, let's say, they would arrive in the second round. However, I think that in that case, Marine Le Pen would win hands down. She would beat either Hamon or Mélenchon. And I can say that for Jean-Luc Mélenchon, he would rather lose, and he would rather see capitalism win then let the FN win.
Of course. Yeah. Socialists don't actually believe that there's going to be socialism in the world. What they want is globalized liberal capitalism with left-wing values on top, which is basically what the center-right is allowing as well.
Yeah, exactly.
They're for the establishment. They are not for the workers. They're not for socialism. They're for neoliberalism and left-wing values.
Yeah, so he...
Left-wing oligarchy, basically.
Yeah, this guy understands strategy. He understands what would happen if he were to drop out, or if the other, if Hamon were to drop out and join him. You know, he understands what would happen, and I think he's gonna, I would be surprised if that happened. So I think we're gonna see Marine Le Pen either versus Macron, or after this near-death experience, Fillon will come back and go to the second round with her. And then it's gonna be a question of, you know, in either case, are you for the establishment or are you against the establishment? Are you for globalization and immigration or are you against it? And the only differences between these guys are, is it going to be slightly more capitalist or slightly less? Are we going to be a little bit concerned about gay marriage or not concerned at all? You know, that's it.
Right.
That's what's in the only difference. And that's not, you know, Marine Le Pen has positioned herself to be entirely focused on immigration and the future of the little French, you know, the average French person. And so she's very, very well positioned for this, for either one of these opponents, from an ideological, political standpoint.
Yeah, but still, it would be more likely that she would win if she went into the second round against a united left.
Correct. Correct, it would be. Yeah, yeah.
Because if there's a united left, then it's more likely that rightists are going to coalesce with her.
Yeah.
Whereas if there's a united right and she's going up with a right-wing candidate, the left is just going to make a Republican front with the center-right against her.
Yeah.
And she's just not likely to pick up that many left-wing defector voters. But is she better positioned to pick up left-wing defectors in this election than the last time she ran?
I believe she is. And she's better positioned certainly than her father was. Because when her father ran in the second round, that was against the center-right Chirac. And he you know, ran the boards against him, basically. In the previous elections, the non-presidential elections, from what I can gather from the numbers, it's not comprehensive, but I've looked at, you know, a lot of these second round scenarios. And I believe it's anywhere from one third at worst to 45% at best of left wing voters who then switch to vote for her. It's a pretty good number, not enough. So what it needs to be then is she has to get all 45% of those, and then these other guys stay home. You know? And that's what needs to happen for her to win. And frankly, like, I've had this conversation with others before about Alain Soral and Dieudonné and how, you know, they don't like, these guys and so on. You know, this is when framing the issue becomes so important, and this is what our prime enemy, the organized Jewish community, is so good at doing. They frame the issue and they give us two options that benefit them. In France, the tables have been turned on them. So you can either, if you're young, either you're going in the direction of the identitarians or you're going in the direction of Dieudonné and Alain Soral. And it's thanks to the existence of those guys that there isn't, that there will not be a united anti-racist Republican front against Le Pen. That coalition has been totally destroyed by the dialectic of Soral and Dieudonné.
That's really very interesting. So, Patrick, I think this is a good time to wrap up. Are there any last words, any final thoughts you want to leave us with about this really historical election?
So I'm going to be very focused on getting this going. I've got quite a few people who don't live in France who are French speakers who will be working on the projects I described. And I only want it to be them because this is questionable stuff, and we wouldn't want it to somehow have a volunteer who's somehow linked to the FN or somehow could get in trouble in France. And anybody who's in France, I think, should be on the ground working for her to get her to win. But outside, we're working on that. I think in the near future, if we have, we have quite a few people now who are, you know, signed on, ready to go, who are vetted. If we open the doors wider, I'll make an announcement in the future. I think now the best thing is if we could have donations from any listeners who are concerned about this, it would really help us along with this. You know, we talked earlier about donations to Countercurrents, where they just specifically earmark it for this project. This is only going on for the next couple months. So, you know, the first round election is the last Sunday in April. That's the 30th of April. And then the second round is May 7th, 2017. So if anyone's listening who would like to support this effort, I've already had conversations with, say, an American donor who gets involved in these things. And unfortunately, it's not going forward on that front. The focus is much more American focused. But if we have small donors out there who believe in this project and who want to see France turn in the nationalist direction, we would really, really love to have your support. And I'll be as transparent as I can during the process of, you know, reporting on what kind of things we're doing generally and so on, and afterwards much more transparent about what it is we've what we can claim credit for accomplishing. And I think that, you know, this is not just about France. It's about changing the direction for Europe. France is after the departure of the United Kingdom, diplomatically, internationally, the most important country in the EU. It's the second largest economy. It's the,
right.
You know, it's a cultural leader, frankly, in the way that Germany is not, you know.
Yeah, it's got a very autarkic economy. It has a nuclear deterrent. It's a real player in the world. And if it goes nationalist, it's not going to be Serbia'd or Austria'd. Right. By NATO and the EU, it's just not going to happen. And if France goes, I think a lot of other countries will go as well. So just to be clear, what we're talking about is you and some Francophone people outside of France, places like Quebec and Belgium or Switzerland, I imagine, are working together to place advertisements that will red pill or black pill, depending on what you want to do, certain kinds of voters in France. You're going to be doing polls and push polls and other things like that. And you're going to be basically trying to frame events on the ground, like the anti-fa violence, jihadi violence, and that kind of stuff, so that it red pills or black pills, again, depending on who you want to get out or stay home, voters that might not otherwise... you want to red pill voters who might not vote for the Front National without this.
Correct. Yeah.
And or get others to stay home. Basically, so you're trying to drive information into the minds of these people, and you'd like some help doing that with donations. And so, if you want to make a donation, dear listener, to help Patrick and his friends out with this project. This is good, solid metapolitics. It's getting right down there in the... It's getting into politics, right? This is getting real now. If you want to help, send a donation through PayPal and use this address, donations, that's a plural, donations, at heidegger.us. That's H-E-I-D-E-G-G-E-R.us, as in Martin Heidegger. Donations at heidegger.us. That's the account that I use for... donations, basically, that I pass on to somebody else. So I used that account a while back when a guy in Berkeley got beaten up by Antifa and had a bunch of medical bills, and people sent a couple $1,000s to him, which I passed on in its entirety. And if you do send something to this thing, make sure it's not a purchase, but a personal gift. There are two options you have with PayPal. One is to send money to family or friends, as they call it. The other is to buy goods and services. This is a family and friends thing, and if you do it that way, PayPal just passes the money on completely. They don't take a cut. It's a kind thing that
they do.
We're
all good friends here.
And
this
is all between friends and family here. So, and our greater racial family. So if you want to help Patrick out, 100% of this, anything you donate, I'll just pass right on to him. It'll help people who are basically, they're trying to pierce the veil of media blackouts and media disinformation that exists in France. And the people in France who are working for the Front National Identitarians, Front National people, they're out there on the streets. But we don't want to just be side, if you don't want to be a spectator, just a spectator on the sidelines, if you are somebody who's outside but concerned, right, to red pill people
absolutely,
in France.
Yeah, this and, is a and way the thing you can is, help I out. Guess, to break these into two sections, you know, we talk about getting information to people. The area where Marine Le Pen is weakest is with the baby boom generation. And all of the clickbait stuff works really, really well with them. You know, for them, that's the internet. You know, Facebook ads, and clickbait news sites. And so that's one area where we'll have a lot of impact. The other is social media. Now, in, for example, Iran, when they had the Green Revolution, this was figured out after the fact by analysis that was done on Twitter in public. It was like public information. A lot of the accounts that were guiding people from location to location, saying, okay, this person was shot here, this person was beaten up by a police here, go to this place to rally, what have you, was carried out by accounts that had been created within a month or two before the event and that were based out of Tel Aviv. So this is a technique that is not special. You don't have to have Kabbalistic magic to carry out this technique. This is something that we're fully capable of doing, and quite a few of us have experience in doing of this. And, you know, the group that we have so far of volunteers is just that. You know, it's volunteers, and it's over 100. I haven't talked to all of them yet personally. But, you know, we have quite a few people, and I think we can make a very, very serious impact. It's one of those things about the, you have to say, people have heard me speak at events, you know, over the past few years since the Trump campaign. My opinion of the cyber side of this game has really changed. You know, early on I say, all right, guys, we got to get out of the streets, we got to do things, you know, in the world of three dimensions. You know, I'd use denigrating phrases like keyboard warriors. You know, in the past year I've had, you know, I think that's still very important and not just important but essential. But I've seen so much and accomplished so much teaming up with these guys, actually, including on the Trump campaign, not directly with those, but at an arm's length, that my opinion's changed, and I'm really impressed with what's possible here. And so we're going to take what I was told was the most effective 72-hour campaign by someone who's high placed and would know what he's talking about, and we're going to take these same tactics, and we're going to have 2 months to carry them out, and I think we'll be able to accomplish great things and have an impact on it. So if people who've seen me talk in person will know more about what I'm talking about, but since we're online, it's going to be a little bit hedged in what we say. So.
Right. Well, Patrick, this is a great conversation. I've really enjoyed this, and we're going to check in from time to time as this campaign unfolds, because really everybody in the white world should be now focusing on what's happening in France. It is of tremendous importance. First it was Brexit, then it was Trump. Let's hope it's Le Pen, then Wilders, and on and on. Let's hope that this is a trend. We do not want to see this trend broken. We want to see this momentum increase. So we're all going to be watching, and we're going to help. We're going to help in whatever way we can by getting information out, getting talking points out, getting memes out, and so forth. And I think that this is a good place to start. And if you want to help, again, send a donation. A friend and family donation to donations@heidegger.us, and we'll help it out. And what a wonderfully pan-European and ecumenical address that is. Martin Heidegger was a German, and it's at .us, but it's all for the greater glory of France.
Fantastic. I'll toast to that.
All right. Take care.
Thank you very much.